I decided to work on ecology, and that's all I've done since I got here, is read, think, sleep, pray about the state of the earth. Really, the biological and chemical foundation for human existence. So that I have a one-track mind. I mean, everybody here knows it's a one-track mind now. We're in trouble. 100 years, life will really be precarious. So that's my position. I don't know where other people are. And there are a whole series of things. We're burying ourselves in garbage. It's gonna warm up, and all kinds of things will happen. The coastlines will disappear. Bangladesh will cease to exist. 15 million people will be inundated by the ocean in Bangladesh. And all up and down the East Coast, all the shore islands, all of those will go. I mean, you can't believe the crops will shift from being the corn belt of the world. Canada will become the corn belt of the world. I mean, the whole thing. Mexico is going to increase from 73 million to 187 million before they level off, and we'll have a Berlin Wall along the Rio Grande. What are you going to do with 100 million more Mexicans, you know, living in the kind of squalor that they live in and knowing the United States exists? I mean, the world, it's going to be a mess. And the ozone, they say the bees are going to go blind and you won't be able to pollinate the fruit trees because the ultraviolet rays. And we'll have glasses and things, but the bees, all the animals will go blind, as a matter of fact, if we continue to do away with the ozone. Let that happen. And those gases are on the way. It takes 8 years for them to get there. There's nothing you can do with those gases that we've already released that are going up there. And one atom of chlorine will counteract, what, about 120,000 molecules or atoms, whatever, molecules of ozone, O3 ozone. I mean, we're in trouble, according to all the books.
I think we should start a new political
party
regarding just strictly environmental.
Green Party, like the Green Party in Germany.
They're around already in this country.
Yeah, they're around. At any rate, that's mine. I don't know how the rest of you feel. I'd like to get a few expressions before we go any further. Whether you sense this future as being really in doubt. You know, I say God is saying no to most of what we are about through the environment. And we know what we're about is destroying people. I mean, it's causing addiction and unemployment and more poor people in this country. Every time production goes up, we get more poverty. I mean, it's a strange kind of a thing in the world. We get more pollution and more poverty. The more we produce, the more we pollute, and the more poverty we have in this country. I mean, the statistics are just there. And so I say that, you know, and I'm crazy. I'm an eco-freak, as they call it now. It took me about 160 days to transform myself and be a kind of normal human being, just kind of trying to do good here and there, not very much of that, to believing that we're in trouble. Now, Ken, you think we're in trouble?
Hey, you bet.
I mean, we're all in trouble personally. I've heard that all weekend.
I'm in trouble.
But I mean, I think we're in trouble biologically, physically.
You know, when I came in December and with Jerry Barney in this international symposium, I was here, and I've been transformed too, and yet I don't act because I still am trapped. You know, you asked me to relate back to this model of people that we talked about, this neutral living axis, about being, I can't say I'm unaware, I'm totally aware, and I totally understand the implications, but it's safe, it's easier to stay over here and not worry about where the beer can goes or the, or whatever, or my car, because I say, well, I have to go to work, you know, and I've got to go to the hospital, or I've got to go here, so it's totally inconvenient to take mass transit. I think it's really frightening to me. It's almost numbing. When you read the statistics and, you know, the way you rattled off all those things, and a lot of people who are just getting into this might say, this guy's crazy.
I am. No, I admit.
But I know what the background is on them, and I think maybe a number of people here do too, when you start reading it, and it's absolutely right on. And I think that it's a matter of personal conversion that lead, like yourself, you know, you've spent the time, you are in the process of conversion so that you can help others to make that go around over here so that we can change corporately and individually.
Well, Tom Schelling, as professor of economics at Harvard, says we're not going to respond to it, so we might as well prepare to adapt to it.
Yeah.
In other words, we're not really going to, I call
well,
it...
Well, the U.S. government, we were told by Barney, said that we are, that although the U.S. government knows exactly what's going on at the highest levels, are preparing for the devastation and the worst rather than to prevent it. We're pressing forward on all fronts that do all this stuff. That's what's scary.
But maybe we need to attack the causes too. I just was thinking, you know, as far as the change of consciousness, I see this as a really, and you alluded to this, a spiritually connected issue. And I see that when we try to just approach causes as an external process, I don't see the motivation for change in individuals, because they're too tied in to those things, those needs that they think have to be fulfilled, you know, through such things as materialism, the whole thrust to gain more, to have power, to have the security that people think they need. So I'm just throwing this out.
Well, there are a lot of people, of course, who are developing a new theology, what they call a theology of creation, mm-hmm. and who think that the important thing is to get out in nature and experience it and begin to get related to nature, so nature becomes something real for you and not simply an external object which mm-hmm. you use and mm-hmm. occasionally you know, see but don't really appreciate the whole natural world. And Thomas Berry and Matthew Fox are the leaders of a whole new theology. They say that our Christian theology is to help us go through this travel of tears, this earthly existence, to escape it. It's a redemption from, and their whole theology is that Christ is the second person of the Trinity. This whole structure reality, you relate to Christ, you relate to the structure of nature, and so-called cosmic Christ, John's prologue, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, everything is full of this kind
right.
of approach.
The fullness of the incarnation being inclusive of all of
right,
creation.
Right. I mean, you take the image of the body in 1 Corinthians and say that image is the image of our relation to nature as well as to people. Mm-hmm. So we are parts of each other. We are, and we have a great... TV, what do you call them?
What is the
tape?
Video.
Videotape on creation and the genetic connection that we have to the first bang. That is that the whole, everything is connected with everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Byron, you've been thinking about this for a while, Byron Swanson. Where are you in all this?
Well, yeah, I guess most of my stuff has just sort of been what I do myself for, seems like forever. When the kids were little, I've been radical and obnoxious too about picking up cans and bottles and anything else and recycling, so the kids wouldn't even want to be seen with me. Or
you'd always be picking them up.
Stop in the middle of the freeway and
and I recycle everything. The neighbors have 5-6 you know, there are these great big huge containers out for a garbage pickup, and I have one little grocery sack because I compost everything, and we go to all sorts of different places to take bottles, cans, aluminum, newspapers, and all the rest. And when I teach, I always somehow bring it in, you know, but I don't know if I'm doing anything like that. It's just, But I couldn't live if I wasn't somehow trying to do something. I agree with you completely. We're in a state of crisis, and it's just, we've all got to become sensitive. We've all got to make radical changes, and it's not the convenient thing to do. It's dirty.
Yeah,
it's inconvenient.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. It's irritating.
That's I'm now right. snipping the windows off of envelopes in order to, you know, I'm spending my time. And so, in one sense, I think it's for the birds.
I hear the smaller points that you're making, but I think one of our big problems. I'm a house builder, and I also do my own architectural designing. I believe in smallness. I have one home designed right now. I haven't built it yet, but it's right around 400 square feet. And I think that's the answer, a big answer to housing for the future. Right now, the average home, I think, is upwards around 110,000, something like this, average in the United States. And a home with about 400 square foot, a person could buy the package complete for somewhere neighborhood of $7,000-$7,500 and own it free and clear, and live in a communal, but I don't mean communal, in an area of say 7 to 10 acres, and have a greenway around the homes that nobody would own, and everybody owns it jointly. And I think that's part of the answer on our housing needs, because right now it just seemed we had the recession in the 80s, and people, you saw some cutting back, but now homes are increasing in square footage, and I can't, for the life of me, I can't understand it. Mortgages are going up, and people are borrowing more and more and more money, and it doesn't seem like it phases them in the least. I can't understand it. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. The banks are behind it. To even buy a home today in the state of Washington, to have it appraised, is going to have an appraiser come out and appraise your home is about $350 just to tell you what the home is worth. I think that's the answer. Small homes, very architecturally, nicely designed, with the highest value.
I assume well insulated, energy efficient.
Right. And a nice covered porch. Gosh, that's good living to me. With burning your mortgage when you buy your property, because you're not going to have any money to speak of in your house.
$7,000 you can be.
$7,000. That's right.
So you get to the population, retention too, where you only have 1.2 kid.
Population. You say?
Yeah, if you're gonna live in a house like that, how can you know you're gonna have to limit your family size and. Right?
Well, nothing wrong with that.
Well, the world's population, of course, that's another great issue. By 2030, it's supposed to be up to about 8.5 billion. It's now about 5.6 billion. It'll be up to 8.5, and by 2100, it will be maybe 15 billion. I mean, that's over 2.5 times what we have now, and it's just happening. And there's no evidence that it's going to slow unless it's slowed by starvation. 25,000, 25,000 kids, 5 and under, who die every day from hunger and related disease. 25,000 kids. And then we look at Matthew 25, 31 to 46, where were you? I mean, it makes a sham out of our Christianity if that happens. And of course, it's all connected with third world development. And they say it's connected with our loan policy, it's connected with our farm policy, that our farm subsidies keep farming from developing these other countries because they keep prices low, and therefore it isn't profitable for them to produce for a world market in these other countries. I mean, the whole thing is so connected. It really floors you, almost.
How can we turn these things around politically? I don't know where we go.
Well, turn it around. I think we have to turn ourselves around first, and I don't know. I just gave a Vespers on beginning with God, and I said, you've got to say no to almost everything that's happening in the world, to you, because we're a part of the whole system. And how else can you be? I mean, you've got to drive. We have two cars, and they get a lot of mileage, and we don't drive them much, but still. You could. There is now a family car. They say, I read this in a magazine published February of 89, a Volvo that gets 63 miles in the city and 81 miles on the highway, and you can buy it. Now, I don't know what it costs. I hope somebody will find out.
It's a Volvo?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of money are we talking about is over against some other kind of a car? What do you got to invest? I mean, you got a problem of investing. And I guess it's worth investing more if you don't pollute. Now, of course, we've got about 135 million cars in this country out of about 500 million in the world. But the whole shebang of autos is about 10% of the carbon emissions, which go up and form the blanket, which increases the heat, but it's 10%. But Barney, when he was here, Jerry Barney, who's a Lutheran and lambasting the church for its uninvolvement and its theory of, you know, subdue the earth, dominate the earth, have dominion over it, use it, abuse it. Anyway, he wrote Global 2000, which was a story, which was a summary of where we were for Carter, and he says we ought to cut our carbon emissions 80%. Now, our chief carbon emissions come from the production of electricity, coal and oil and gas that's used in the production of electricity or in industrial processes. Now, that would take a mite at doing to cut 80% of the energy use. Now, one of the ways you can cut that energy use is by efficiency. And I think everybody I've read says you can cut 25-30% of your carbon emissions by virtue of energy efficiency and make money. I mean, it's a profitable thing to do. It makes sense to cut your energy use. And it's just like this house. I mean, it's your house. Lovins, who's been working on this stuff for a while, says, every home has the equivalent of a square yard of openness. It's just like you had a hole in your home that he knows about. And you may, you know, if you take all the cracks and all the things in the house which permit energy to get out, the heat to get out, you've got about the equivalent of a square yard of just open hole. So the first thing to do, of course, is to, if you got a home, is to have an energy audit. And they got all kinds of devices now, and some of the utility companies will do it free. And if they don't, you ought to press them to do it and make an energy audit. And, you know, well, at any rate, we have this 50 simple things to do, and I wish I had copies of it. But it goes out of print as soon as they make it. It's the best thing I know to kind of explain the situation and to give you some things you can do about it. But the next best, the only thing I can give you is this list that I gave you on living toward God's future. What can we do? What can we do?
I think another thing, too, is like the city of Los Angeles, they have a humongous pollution problem, and a section of land is 640 acres, and I think if you take four sections of land in LA County and jackhammer the streets out and do away with the automobiles in the four sections, and just use an area for your delivery and your emergency vehicles only, and the rest of it put into parks and put it into small planned homes, like I'm saying, and allow the people to live in these and study them as they're living in, and see how they interact with their neighbors and how they feel about it, how they feel about not having a mortgage, because so many people have mortgages on their homes and they're not going to have a car, and see how they relate to the rest of the world.
This fellow I've been reading, Rudolf Barrow, who's one of the leaders of the Green Party in Germany, says the Hopi had communities of 3,000, self-sufficient communities of 3,000. And so I'm, you know, in kind of jest almost, not completely. I've said, well, let's try one. I told Scott here, I said, let's have a hole in two. Let's get a community and let's get some small industry. Let's produce all our own organic food. Let's have our own school. Let's be able to bicycle everywhere. Let's get rid of the cars. Let's get rid of our dependence on the rest of the world insofar as we can. You can't do it completely. We're not going to manufacture cars in the near future in a community like that, certainly. And you're going to have some things you're dependent on the whole culture. But let's try it. And I'm with you.
How many acres would you need for that? I like that idea.
Oh, I don't know. I think
there's a lot.
I would think you might need a couple of acres a person. Maybe I would think you'd want if you had 3,000 people, you'd probably want 6,000 acres. That's a little bigger than yours. A couple acres a person. You'd want your, you know, ideally you'd have it by a clean river and by a lake, and you'd have a forest and you'd have all the stuff that Holden has in a way. You'd have it, plus you'd have the whole community. The problem with Holden is it's so abstract. It doesn't support. You can't stay here forever. I mean, it just hasn't ever. But you'd have your own theater, and you'd have your own, you'd have your shops, and you'd have your weaving places. All that stuff would be in this community, so that you had all the creative activities for children and for older people to do it together. And everything you got here, you would have in some sort of collective way. And you'd have enough people in it so you wouldn't have to deal with everybody. I mean, you're not going to like everybody in any community, and you got to have enough variety so there's a chance for interaction and differences. And anyway, if we in fact have to cut down on our production of things in order to save the world from heating up beyond, you know, recall, then it seems to me you've got to find another way of living from what we have. And I think there's certain advantages in that way of living myself. You know, in some ways, ever since I came to Holden, I've wanted to do this sort of thing. And we have a community. We have a 21 flat building which 60 people live, and we take care of each other, kind of, and share a lot of stuff. But we haven't got the wherewithal to support ourselves. So we're dependent completely on going out into that world. And it's perfect. We have a woman who took 13 years to get her PhD. She was in our community and in the university community. And that's strange. Now she's teaching in the university. And she said, oh, everybody has a home. Everybody has all this stuff. And here I am living with you. I mean, you know, in a quite different style of life and a quite different pattern. And the strain is right there every day, and which way you go, and the strain on your kids, because you send your kids out into a world where everybody has a Nintendo and everybody has all this stuff, and I don't know how you get rid of that.
But Europe has been doing this for years, and they're so much better than we are here in the States.
Some of the countries are far ahead of us.
Yeah.
But of course, they still, the Black Forest is what, 25% destroyed in Germany? And I mean, they haven't.
Yeah.
But the rivers are polluted.
We should pick up some examples.
The rivers are polluted. Yeah, they have certainly moved on some of this stuff more. Well, I don't know how the rest of you respond. What does this, you know? We're supposed to get into our heart now and our gut, not our head.
Well, I'd say it's up to people like you, the environmental extremists. If you don't do your job, Mother Nature will, just like she does with the rabbit cycle. It's just going to happen.
Yeah.
What about our job, though? I mean,
well,
what can we do?
Join in.
Yeah, well, I got 45 things you can do to stop the carbon emissions, and then I went to ozone. And I've been writing a kind of manifesto on, and I have the thing done on global warming, and I've done it on ozone, and the next thing I'm working on is water, and I've got 12 of these issues, which I've also got listed on some piece of paper. There's some stuff on the harpsichord that you might want to look at, and. There's also a list there in case you want to keep in touch with us. You know, I'm an organization person. I just had a letter from a woman who's in a church of 7,000 people. Think of being in a church with 7,000 people and getting 7,000 people moving like this. Man, so I sent her everything I could. Everything I could. And it's good. She was on the list. Now, I'm willing to send you and do everything. And if I get copies of this, I'll send them to you. If you just put after your name that you want it, and if you want to send me the money, fine, but this is crucial.
I think, what's your first name?
Al.
Al, I think the way to start a community like this would go ahead and draw up a list here in Holden, and the ones that aren't interested in living in a community like this, we'll go ahead and put our names on the list, and as soon as we and get the amount of people that we need and the amount of assets. I mean, we have to have a certain amount of cash to do all of this. And we go ahead and we do it.
You know, and we got to find some benefactor too. But we had to do it. We bought our building on a shoestring, and the church mortgaged itself in order to help us rehab the building and so forth. You know, I believe these things are possible.
Where do you live?
Chicago. We live right near the university. I taught at the university 26 years, and all this kind of stuff was kind of at the heart of my being, and most of the time I was trying to do it as well as teach it. And the university didn't like that too well. But then they, you know, I got my tenure, and then they couldn't do anything. So,
could you explain a little bit about the ozone? I know that there's something going on.
The ozone? Ozone is O3. You've got oxygen, which is O2, the molecule of oxygen. Then under certain conditions, O3 forms, and lightning and ultraviolet rays and so forth, it splits the oxygen off, and then it combines and forms O3. O3 prevents ultraviolet rays from the sun getting through to the earth. And so if you have a measure of O3, it will prevent that. The less ozone you have, they think, you know, and they've made all the studies which indicate, and they've tried this with some simulated experiences, if you have certain kinds of chemicals that are released and travel up to the stratosphere, that's about 10 miles, 8 miles to 25 miles up, there's this layer up there, and if they get there, they destroy the O3. Therefore, more ultraviolet rays come through, and therefore, there's more skin cancer. I mean, the skin cancer is directly related to the ultraviolet rays that are coming, and it's on the increase. And it's on the increase greatly in Australia, and there's a big ozone hole over the Antarctic. At some points in the year, There's no ozone over the Antarctic. Well, Australia and the South American countries that are near there are going to be subject then to that ozone kind of hole affecting them. The air in circulating will mean there's less ozone over Australia, and the percentage of cancer in Australia is going up. And there's several kinds of cancer. But skin cancer will take place. Then that affects the immune system somewhat like AIDS does, if there's extra. And they've tried this. It stops the plants growing in the oceans to have more ultraviolet rays. Some of the plants on which phytoplankton and others on which fish are dependent for their lives. And it affects certain plastics. It just destroys them. So these are said to be facts. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Who am I to say? And then they affect your eyes. So that eventually you will have to wear glasses if this ozone layer continues to decrease. And there are certain gases. The chlorofluorocarbons, which are used in aerosols, have been used in aerosols, not supposed to be used anymore. Halons, bromines that are in fire extinguishers, methane, and some nitrous oxides, N2O, that all have the same kind of chemical interaction with the O3, which cause it to break down into O2, and so that with methane it would be water and O2, so that it's being destroyed, and they're measuring it. There are all kinds of systematic now efforts to measure the ozone layer. The other thing that they have, they are also taking measurements of the content of the atmosphere from thousands and thousands of years ago by digging into ice and finding out what happened. So there are all kinds of correlations between ice ages and the level of CO2 in the atmosphere. And there are all kinds of measurements about where the ozone is and where it is and whether it's decreasing or not. And the measurements seem to indicate that there is a decrease in the ozone generally, and there is an ozone hole at certain periods of the year over the Antarctic. There just isn't any. So, that's what I've come to understand. And there are some debates, of course, and some people say it's for the birds, and some people say that the warming that we've had the far warmest years in the 80s that we've had in the last 100 years. The summers have been the warmest. And there's still debate as to whether this is real or whether it's part of a long-term cycle, but there's a new book out by Stephen Schneider, and if anybody's interested in global warming, that is the book to read, I think. But he said, well, somebody in Congress in the congressional hearing asked him what the percentage of, what chances are that you're right? He said, 1 in 2. So the guy said, well, you may or may not be right. But he said, I could be wrong 1 or 2, or I could be right. Are you willing to take that chance? 50-50. It's like insurance. Given that kind of chance, I'm not giving you anything that can be said to be fact. But there are facts that support this line of argument and this interpretation of what is happening to us.
How about, why don't you talk a little bit about the acid rain problem back east?
Well, the acid rain problem.
Yeah.
The fact is that industrial processes, wherever you use coal particularly, oil some, but particularly coal, there are nitrogen oxides and sulfur oxides, which are given off. And they're given off in the air, and then when it rains, these are soluble and they form acid, nitric acid, HNO3, and sulfuric acid, H2SO4. And these acids then, either the air with these gases is absorbed by the water and changes the water, or when the rain comes down, it brings these acids, and these acids then affect they affect soil, they affect water, they affect vegetation. And I saw the trees in the what's the southern range there? You go down into Tennessee, and anyway, I saw
Smoky
the
Mountains.
Hey, pardon?
Smoky Mountains.
Smokies, yeah, the Smokies, the fir trees that were just dying.
Yeah.
Their interpretation was that the acids affect the health of the tree, and then insects destroy the tree. That's what they were saying. They had no.
Right on the mountain summits, that's where it's been the hardest hit, isn't it?
But it's all over the rivers. The other thing that happens, of course, is that with all the nitrogen fertilizers, the fertilizers sink into the soil with the water and then affect all our water sources. So there are places where these, where there are all kinds of diarrhea and so forth that come from this excess nitrogen in the water. So that our water is being polluted, and the, both from the fertilizers and the pesticides, so that the water is influenced. So that this is just another whole area of problem, and of course Canada, the, somehow it's the Northeast that's most affected by this acid rain problem, and our stuff from the industrial north, central and northeast blows into Canada and affects the Canadian forest. So there's been big to-do with the Canadians about, and we can do some things about this. And one is to cut down on our use of coal, which seems somewhat unlikely because the whole thrust of our whole culture is to increase the GNP. I mean, that God is GNP in this country. And so, and it's clear, I mean, Bush has said it, and we have a cartoon up on the bulletin board just as you come in the door of the dining room, if you come from the what direction, the east, which indicates Bush saying, you know, we're not going to stop the industrial growth because of the environmental problems. And he's just dug his heels on it, and our whole administration is built on the thesis that if you, and here there's a really interesting new book out on the common good and economics, and it really attacks our whole philosophy of economics, which simply doesn't have any place to take into account the environment. There's no way in our economic system to factor in the future, because it's people's self-interest in the present which determine what happens in our economy, and without some institution. The socialist countries are set up ideally to handle this problem, but they aren't handling the problem as well as we are, because the drive in those countries is for GNP too. The god of all the societies, there's no difference between socialism and capitalism in terms of what drives them. What drives them? You really need some centralized institutions. Actually, you need worldwide institutions, because if one nation does something and another nation doesn't do it, you're not going to solve your problem. If you've got global warming. Now, one of the great problems is that third world economic development is taking place, and if the third world had the economic development that we did, that we have, instead of 5.6 billion tons of carbon dioxide, would have 20 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year. If they had, and insofar as they are imitating us and moving toward our kind of economic development, and I mean, there's all kinds of things that are needed, of course, and we need solar, we need energy efficiency, we could tremendous amount, and I've talked a little about energy efficiency and the kind of things you can do in this paper, But the government should, I think, have a dollar a gallon tax on gasoline. We ought to make it profitable for people to buy cars that go get more per gallon, and therefore the auto manufacturers, we do have some regulation, but the auto manufacturers keep trying to prevent that regulation. We're getting about, what, 26.2 now, the average of a fleet for a year, a company has to get 26.2 miles, and that's good, but we should have 40 or 50 miles as the level, and we could. There's no question that there are all kinds of things we could do to help in a kind of technological fix. This guy in Germany says, well, we're not going to do it, and it's not enough anyway, so that's where he comes down on trying to get an alternative. And of course, the other thing is to produce an alternative that's relevant for the rest of the world. The greatest mission thing we could do for the rest of the world would be to provide an illustration of a technology that would be relevant for the 22nd century. A technology.
Well, you're talking about there a new form of energy or something that would change everything all at once.
Well, one of the suggestions is that you put big solar stations in our southwest and you form hydrogen and burn the hydrogen. That's one of the suggestions that hydrogen would burn clean. Of course, you get water. So that it's possible. There also is a proposal that we have much smaller nuclear fission projects. And of course, you could put a lot of money into fusion on the basis that fusion might turn up in the next 15, 20 years to be a much cleaner way to produce energy. The sun, you know, it's unbelievable. The sun is 27 million degrees centigrade at the center, 27 million degrees centigrade, and that 600 million tons of hydrogen are turned into helium every second. I mean, if you can turn, and I mean, there are all kinds of processes that might produce this energy, but until we get them, we have to do something quite different, personally. Well, I think that's enough, isn't it?
I got one more question. If the environmentalists hadn't stopped the development of atomic generated power, don't you think the world would be cleaner today?
Well, not enough to make that much difference. Our chief problem with atomic energy is the waste. We don't know what to do with the waste. I understand the other day they decided not to do something with the waste in Washington, and somebody said, well, it'll be another 10 years. They'll be sitting around not knowing how to dispose of them. The disposal of waste is still, nobody knows what to do with them. And of course, you can bury them in the sea, but when these things rust through, what happens? Bury them in mines. Who knows what the water and what the shifting geological patterns are. I mean, I guess there's some people who know more than others about whether how safe it is.
Wasn't there a plan to encase them in glass blocks?
I don't know. I haven't gotten into. Actually, that's my 12th problem. Is the nuclear. Chiefly because I don't know anything to do.
How about those atomic test sites down in Nevada? Aren't there great big holes in the ground there? They're already.
Wherever there's nuclear energy, I think there's a problem.
They're already full of radiation. Why not throw it in?
But I don't think we're going to go nuclear. There's just too much resistance to it. We got to do all the rest of the stuff.
We need something new.
Well, I'm not sure it'll be anything new, but I don't think hydrogen technology is not new, it's just undeveloped to develop hydrogen. Solar is there, photovoltaic. I don't know what you got on your house roofs, but you could have photovoltaic, they tell me.
Well, I live in Collis County here in Washington, and we have the cheapest electrical rates here in the state of Washington. Actually, probably
that doesn't look too, that doesn't let you off the hook.
Because, I know that.
Because
it's
you can transfer the hydroelectric power from this system to a system that's using coal. And so everything you save in Washington, all the electricity can be then transferred and prevent the use of coal to produce electricity in some other system. They say Canada has 300,000 megawatts of electricity from water power that's possible. And they could develop that and practically serve our nation, if they were 300,000 megawatts. That's a lot of electricity. Anyway,
have you got the aquifers yet?
Thank you for. Sure. Oh, we got all kinds of problems with that.
I know that the rural areas are depleting the aquifers by doing all this
irrigation.
And you know they're putting it up in the air out there, like in Minnesota, out in the vast in those places, and they lose so much to the sun. And then the leaves of the corn and stuff evaporate so much of it, so the whole lot of it is not used.
Well, of course, they've got a new technology for watering. You water the roots, and of course, that's part of the whole transformation we have to have. So you use your irrigation water, you could use it, I think, about 40-50% more efficiently if you watered the roots instead of just pouring it out. I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a big percentage.